Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 So we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 26, Text 17. Kim mataya na pakritam rajbhava swapa cetasaha drastu swarup visduso yoham yad ajitendriya kim. What? Etaya, by her. Na, to us. Apakritam, offense has been done. Rajva, by a rope. Va, or. Sarpachetasaha, who is thinking it to be a snake? Dristaha, of such a seer. Swarupa, the real identity. Avidusa, who does not understand. Ya, who? Aham, I. Yat, because of. Ajitendriya, having not controlled the senses. Translation. How can I blame her for my trouble when I myself am ignorant of my real spiritual nature? I did not control my senses, and so I am like a person who mistakenly sees a harmless rope as a snake. Translation responsibly. How can I blame her for my troubles when I myself am ignorant of my real spiritual nature? I did not control my senses, and so I'm like a person who mistakenly sees a harmless rope as a snake. Purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. When a person mistakes a rope for a snake, he becomes fearful and anxious. Such fear and anxiety are, of course, illusion, and since the rope can never bite. Similarly, one who mistakenly thinks that the material world, the illusory energy of the Lord, exists for his personal sense gratification, will certainly bring down on his head an avalanche of material illusory fear and anxiety. King Pururava frankly admits here that the young lady Urvasi is not to blame. After all, it was Pururava who mistakenly considered her to be an object of his personal enjoyment, and therefore he suffered the reactions by the laws of nature. Pururava himself was the offender for trying to exploit the external form of Urvasi. Translation again. How can I blame her for my troubles when I myself am ignorant of my real spiritual nature? I did not control my senses, and so I'm like a person who mistakenly sees a harmless rope as a snake. Has anybody done that? Has anybody mistakenly mistaken a rope for a snake? Anybody? Been in the country? We did when we were in Gaudadesh. We had a farming community many years ago up near Mildura, and snakes were plentiful up there. And sometimes there'd be like a black hose lying in the garden, and you'd think it was a snake, you know, because there were just so many snakes up there. It was just amazing. And straight away, even though it was just a piece of polyurethane pipe, you straight away think, oh my God, it's a snake, you know, and you felt the adrenaline coming up in your body and the anxiety. It was an amazing place, actually, New Gaudadesh. It was something like Mayapur. It was a beautiful property, very, very big, but it had a lot of snakes. And if you went down to the river, you had to be really careful, because there used to be a beach that you could swim in the Murray River. At that stage, the Murray was flowing. very opulently, and you could go there and you could swim. But sometimes you'd be swimming and you'd see a snake go going past, or a kangaroo would swim across the river. Do you remember that, Garner? Did you go up there? And yeah, interesting. So sometimes we used to mistake a snake, not a rope, but a piece of pipe as a snake. So here we have the king. Now he's finally coming to his senses. How can I blame poor Uvasi? You know, it was his own self-ignorance, his own misunderstanding of what his real nature was, that he was spirit soul, that he's a divine spirit soul, part and parcel of the Supreme Lord. He didn't understand this. He underestimated himself. When we actually become conditioned in this material world and we look at our own personal existence, we underestimate who we actually are. When we're contaminated by the material consciousness, we're actually part and parcel of Krishna. Think about that. We're actually part and parcel of Krishna. We're a part, a spark of the Supreme Divine Personality. It's amazing. Sometimes we think, you know, oh, we're so conditioned, so trapped, but we're actually, you know, we can't take the bad bargain. We're actually an incredible personality in our own self. When we don't actually come to that understanding, and we're illusion, we're actually undoing ourselves. We're really not giving our full self-worth. So the spirit soul is eternal, as it says in Bhagavad Gita, Najayate Miyate Bhagavachin. For the soul there is never birth nor death, nor having once been does he ever cease to be. He's unborn, eternal, ever-existing, undying and primeval. He's the very first. You were very first there. This is not the first life you've had. You're ever existing, and you're not slain when the body is slain. So the soul is perpetually going on. It was interesting. I got an opportunity to listen to my spiritual master yesterday, and he was saying so many people are so fearful of being slain, and so many people are fearful of dying, but a devotee is never concerned so much about the dying process. Even the Christians are constantly thinking that they need salvation. You know, that they need to go to heaven. But the devotees are not like that. You know, there is an emphasis that we should strive to go back home, back to Godhead, and we do. We strive for that. But really, if a devotee is comfortably situated in service to the Lord, irrespective of what body you've got, it doesn't make any difference, just as long as you can keep on serving. And he was saying, like, if a person is really dedicated to the service of Krishna and Guru, it really doesn't matter where they are, in what planet they are, and how they, just as long as they are serving. And if they're making progress in that service, it's guaranteed that in the next lifetime you'll progress from that progress. And he was saying, actually, where do you think you are? You know, where do you think you are, actually? I mean, if we say we're on this earth planet, but what is this earth planet, actually? This earth planet is this little speck spinning around the star in this universe, in this galaxy, when there are millions and millions of other planets and stars and everything. And in this lifetime, we just happen to land on this little planet, and we're doing our pastimes on this little planet, but actually, in our next lifetime, we could be on another universe, in another universe, in another planet. The main thing, the main crux that the devotees are always aware of is that no matter where we are, no matter which planet we land on, no matter where, just as long as we have the ability to serve. Just as long as we have the ability to serve. The other day I had an opportunity in my interfaith capacity to go to a lecture given by a very erudite scholar, a Vaishnava, a Sri Vaishnava guru and swami at one of the centres in Burwood. Did anybody go to that lecture? You went to one of the lectures? Yeah. He actually came here also, Swami Krishna. He actually came here on Saturday and he wanted to see the deities of the Lord. Anyway, I had an opportunity to go and listen. And, you know, it was very, very nice, the lecture that he gave. Very, very interesting. But when I walked out of that lecture, I was so... And he's a Vaishnava. He's a lover of God. He sees God as a personality. But they see the Lord as Narayan. You know? And the lecture that I went to was all about Saranagati, explaining about surrender, that it just means to surrender. Your life is meant to surrender to God. And that the goal of life is to achieve mukti, moksha, you know. This was the crux of his teaching, which is correct. But when I walked out of that lecture, I was so incredibly appreciative of Srila Prabhupada, because he never actually explained, well, how do you surrender? How do you perform this Saranagati? What do you do to surrender? Do you come before the Lord and Lord Narayan and just sort of stand there? Okay, I'm surrendering. Yeah, it feels like I'm surrendering. No. There wasn't a practical, and I wanted to ask him a question. How do we practically surrender? You are talking about the Saranagati, but how can we practically surrender to the Lord? And he couldn't explain. It wasn't explained on that night. He probably could explain it, but it wasn't explained on that night. Even on the other nights. So Prabhupada, the first thing that he said is that a devotee has the opportunity to serve, whether it's making ghee wicks, making a garland, engaging in so many ways. So simple. Straight from the first time that Prabhupada landed here in the West, he engaged people in service. It wasn't just a question of wanting to somehow or other receive mukti, some liberation, doing some procedure, some puja or something. It was engaging. Practical, simple engagement. You know, working for the Lord. And Prabhupada's emphasis wasn't so much on mukti or moksha, getting out of here and going back to the Vaikuntha planets. Not at all. His goal was, yes, we're going to the spiritual world eventually. If you're a devotee, eventually you'll go to the spiritual world. No doubt about it. But his emphasis was, make the spiritual world here. While you're in this material world, while you're here, make this the spiritual world. And how do we do that? We do that by service. By engaging our body in service to the Lord. And not worrying so much about liberation and salvation. The Christians have this big thing, to turn to Jesus, and gain salvation. It was interesting, I was at my Jewish chiropractor the other day, and he said, Bhakta, do you want to hear a joke? And I said, yeah, why not? I like jokes. And I said, if it's a good one, I'll tell it the next time I give a class. And it's about salvation. It's about going to heaven. And it was really interesting. He said, there's two people. There's a Jewish rabbi and a bus driver. And they both leave the material world. They both die at about the same time. And the Jewish bus driver goes there and the rabbi. Now, the rabbi was known for giving long sermons. Very in-depth, very erudite scholar. He quoted the Torah and he quoted all the different Bibles. And he was very, very erudite. Big, big rabbi. Great, great man. Very pure man. And he deserved to go to heaven. And the bus driver, he arrived also at the same time. So they enter heaven. And the bus driver goes in first. And there's angels, Gandharvas. And there's great personalities to meet this person. And they give him a great fanfare. Come into heaven. Thank you so much. Come into heaven. The gates of heaven for you. He was a good man. Come into heaven. The gates of heaven are open for you. And then the rabbi comes in, and one little angel comes in. Yeah, come on in. And the rabbi goes, what is this? I'm glad I'm here. But why does he get such a big fanfare, and I only get one angel to greet me when I come to heaven? And he said, one of the angels said, well, you have to understand, Rabbi, you gave a lot of sermons, and they were long sermons. And when you had those sermons, a lot of people fell asleep. But that bus driver, every time he drove people in that bus, boy, did they start to pray. So he deserves a lot of praise. I said, that's a good one. I'll tell that one as a class. So the materialist is always the spiritualist. They're trying to achieve salvation. They're trying to achieve salvation. So the other thing that's mentioned here, a materialist whose condition is constantly in a fearful state of existence, constantly fearing. And that's true, because they have nothing to hold on to. Everything is a rope or a snake. Is it a rope? Is it a snake? You know, in this material world, we're always in anxiety. Should I go this way? Should I go that way? If you haven't got Krishna in your life, you're never sure. Shall I go that way? Oh, I don't know. Shall I take that path in my life? Shall I marry that lady? Or shall I marry that man? Shall we have children? Shan't we have... There's so much fear. But for a devotee, there is no fear. This is the first thing that I realized as a devotee when I took initiation. The very first thing, and the biggest fear that we have is fear of death. Some people have a fear of public speaking, and they say that actually public speaking is more fearful than death for some people. But the majority of us fear death, the unknown. And the first thing that I remember when I became a devotee and I was initiated, because the initiation process is such a wonderful thing. Here you have, you're linking up back with Krishna, and Krishna is saying, and through the spiritual master, I'll make all the arrangements for you to forget your karma, forget all the sins that you've committed, and now you can serve Krishna. And the first thing that I remember as a devotee was, I felt cleansed. I felt free. And I didn't have to fear anymore. Because my spiritual master, my loving father, was now looking after me. And I could fulfill the process of serving the Lord. And the service meant everything. And my spiritual father, my mentor, my spiritual guide, was giving me the right opportunity to learn to serve the Lord. And Srila Prabhupada set that up for all of us for many, many years to come. Nobody compares to the teachings that Srila Prabhupada has given us. The other thing that was mentioned was this whole thing about pap, sin. Did he mention that as well? How it's a big thing? How Narayan actually feels if we're presenting ourselves for surrender before Narayan, Narayan will see our pap, our sin, and we somehow have to eradicate that sin. Well, Krishna, loving Krishna, never sees our sin. He only sees the good things that we do. The real situation, from the teachings of Srila Prabhupada, he tells us that actually, yes, we are all sinful. We're all works in progress. We're all in this material world, in this prison house. And we're all struggling to free ourselves from this prison house. And as devotees, we've got the means by which we can free ourselves from this prison house. But we're not overwhelmed by the sin. You know, because we understand just by engaging this body, this lifetime in service to God, the spiritual master and Krishna will take care of all the different inebrieties and all the different wayward thoughts and wayward things that we've done in our past. Krishna says, don't mind for that. I'll look after you. You know, Krishna takes control. And Krishna only sees the good that we do. Krishna only ever sees the devotional service we do. Just like a parent. The parent only likes to see the good things. And the negative things, when you have a 21st birthday party, in the West, we have a big deal about a 21st birthday party. The parents always bring up all the good things that the child has done in their life. They don't talk about the soiled nappies and the time they burnt the cat or anything like that, or burnt the house down. No. They only think about the good things that the child has done. And so Krishna is the same. Well, he knows we're all works in progress. And if you've taken to the path of devotional service, he knows that these people are making an effort. Now I'll look after them, and I only see the good in what they're doing. Even this king, he's been such a, as they say in Australia, a whacker, by just being so completely enamoured by this whole sexual thing, this whole intoxicating material attachment to Urvasi. You know, Krishna actually even doesn't see. Now he starts to see. Ah, now you're becoming to your senses. Now you're becoming sane. In the next one, the next verse, it's actually said that now the king is becoming sane. So when we come to this devotional service, we start to become sane. Everybody else is insane. And actually everybody else, as is pointed out in the Bhagavad Gita, is nothing more than a mudha, a fool. So the king openly admits that he's a fool, that he went down this path. In the Bhagavad Gita 7.15, you have that verse, Namam Duskritino Mudha, where Prabhupada says, you know, Krishna says, you're Mudha. Actually, I wanted to read the purport to that one, if you don't mind. It's a really interesting section. Prabhupada says here, the verse is in chapter 7, text 15, Nama Duskritina Mudha, Prabhajanti Naradhama, Mayaya Patarit Jagyana, Asuram Baba Asrita. Thus, those miscreants who are grossly foolish, lowest among mankind, whose knowledge is stolen by illusion, and who partake of the atheistic nature of demons, do not surrender unto me. It is said in the Bhagavad Gita that simply by surrendering oneself unto the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality Krishna, one can surmount the stringent laws of material nature. The surrendering process is service. Be clear about that. Prabhupada has made that so clear. Our surrendering process is service. What more service can I do? An idle hand is the devil's playground. So we have to constantly think, what can I do to serve? Either by work, by service in the mind, by learning, studying the Shastras, engaging with other devotees. So, at this point a question arises. How is it that educated philosophers, scientists, businessmen, administrators, all the leaders of ordinary men do not surrender to the lotus feet of Krishna, the all-powerful personality of Godhead? Mukti, or liberation from the laws of material nature, is sought by the leaders of mankind in different ways and with great plans and perseverance for many years and many births. But if that liberation is possible by simply surrendering unto the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then why do these intelligent, hard-working leaders adopt this simple method? The Gita's answer is very frank. Those really learned leaders, just like Brahma, Shiva, Kapila, the Kumaras, Manu, Vyas, Devala, Asita, Ajnana, Prahlad, Bali, and later on Madhvacharya, Ramanujacharya, Sri Chaitanya, and many others, who are faithful philosophers, politicians, educators, scientists, etc., surrender to the lotus feet of the Supreme, the all-powerful authority. Those who are not actually philosophers, scientists, educators, etc., but who pose themselves as such for material gain, do not accept the plane or path of the Supreme Lord. They have no idea of God. They simply manufacture their own worldly plans and consequently complicate the problem of material existence in their vain attempt to solve it. Because material energy, nature, is so powerful, it can resist the authorized plans of the atheist and baffle the knowledge of the plan commissioners. Now later, this is a really big purport that Prabhupada gives here. And he goes on to explain that there are four kinds of men that do not surrender to the Lord. So the first one, that is the mudhas. And we know we bandied that word around a lot. Oh, you mudha, foolish fellow. So these are the grossly. These are like the beasts of burden, the asses. You know, Prabhupada says, dogs, hogs, camels and asses. So these are the first class of mudha. These are the people that don't surrender to the Supreme Lord. So they're the hard-working, everyday, again in Australian colloquialism, the yobbo. Go on, you mate. She'd be right. You know, they eat heartily, they eat anything, they have a strong sex desire, they work hard, they sleep, they serve illusory masters, and they're foolishly wasting their time, day after day after day, in nonsensical entertainment. Go and watch the footy. Some of you devotees work with these kind of people, where the first thing they come in on Monday morning, what's the topic of conversation? Jeez, they got done, didn't they? That was a good game, wasn't it? Or the cricket, now it's cricket. They just constantly have this diversion, so they don't have to think deeply. All they think about is the football or the soccer or the cricket or something. And in the ladies' side of it, they talk about the latest fashions and this thing and that thing. And so, and they also blame others, like the king was doing, blame others for their problems. You know, the boss is always wrong. You know, the job stinks because the boss is wrong. Oh, my wife is such a hassle. Oh, my husband, he's no good. And there's always blaming. So these are mudhas. They blame their troubles on the government. We've got to change the government. They're not doing what they should be doing. So that's the mudha. The second type of miscreant is the Narodhama. Now, we're familiar with the Narodhama. They're the lowest of mankind. And out of 8,400,000 species of life, there are 400,000 species of human life. 400,000 species of human life. And Prabhupada explains that they are the lowest in this chain of species. They are the most uncivilized. Now, generally speaking, when we talk about uncivilized people, who do we think of? You know, in Western society, if you're talking to somebody, well, you know, it's those people in Africa or the Aborigines, they're uncivilized. But are they really? Are they really? When we heard the discussions that Kadambakanana Maharaj was giving about in that interview. Has anybody seen that interview that we did with Kadambakanana Maharaj at the theatre? Very, very interesting. And he was talking about the natives in Africa and how they're so close to Vedic culture. And in my dealings in interfaith, I've been having a lot of dealings and studying a little bit about the indigenous culture here in Australia. And they're actually very, very amazing personalities. They believe in a supreme person. Just because they don't dress in a suit or something, and just because at this time, because of the degradation of their culture by Western influence, and they're now intoxicated and have difficulty trying to adjust to Western civilization, when you get to the crux of Aboriginal culture, it's actually very, very interesting and very, very closely aligned to Vedic culture. I don't know, I've said it once in this class how I met this Aboriginal leader who told me how they actually pray. Did anybody remember how? I was always fascinated to find out how does an Aboriginal pray to God. If you believe in a personal God, do you believe in a personal God? Brian said, yes, we do. How do you pray to God? And they said, we pray to God through the earth. And the earth planet is our mother. So Bhumi, same. And our prayers go up to God by our dancing. I said, wow, that's far out. So you see the Aboriginal when they have a corroboree and they dance, and it's like jumping up and down. That's actually their prayers to God in gratitude, in thanks for the life that they've got, for providing them the things they need. And they know that their prayers are being heard by the Lord because the dust is rising when they... So they pray to Bhumi, please be our mediator to God. And they know that the prayers are going up to God by the dust rising. So that's why you see Aboriginals dancing. So their culture is amazing. And their culture doesn't slaughter cows. They may eat snakes. They may eat kangaroo. But they don't slaughter a cow. And they don't kill unnecessarily. They don't have big slaughterhouses. They only have what they need to survive. It's not right, obviously, but again, you have to ask, well, who's civilized and who's not civilized? In this Western society, we destroy the planet. It is said that the Aboriginal culture here, the indigenous culture here in Australia, existed for 60,000 years and the planet wasn't disturbed in any way, shape or form by then. And yet the Westerner comes to Australia and they pollute and damage the earth within 200 years. So who is really civilized and who is uncivilized? So these people are Narodhamas, the uncivilized in society. Narodhamas, no religious principles. No, they're not interested in religion. Their religion is actually, you know, their sport or their engagement, something or other. Now Lord Nityananda, the merciful incarnation of the Supreme Lord, he went out to actually get these Narodhamas engaged. They don't want to be engaged in spiritual life. Just like Jagai Madai had no inclination whatsoever to be engaged in spiritual life. Not a scary. We all know the story of Jagai Madai. You know who they are. They're very, very debauched personalities at the time of Lord Chaitanya. And Lord Chaitanya's mission, the Sankirtan mission, was to go out and present this Krishna consciousness to everyone in the sound vibration of the holy name. So Lord Nityananda and Advaita Acharya would go out on Harinam, and they specifically pointed to these two Naradamas, Jagai and Madalai, and they didn't want anything to do with it. They got the Lord's mercy and they became devotees. So, you know, they were drunkards, they were intoxicants, they were vicious, they were envious, they were rapists, they were killers, they were merciless, and yet the Lord took that risk and went and preached to these people, presented Krishna consciousness to them. So, you know, in our society, I mean, you know, we don't have people like that, or do we? We do. And hang on a tick. What day is it today? Ah, it's Cup Day. Melbourne Cup Day. The race that stops the nation. So we've got this this race on where people bet on poor, tormented animals. You know, these, everybody thinks the grandeur of horse racing. But actually, these horses go through a hellish life to race. They are pushed to the max. And if they don't perform up to the standard, then straight away they're going to the glue factory. It's just such a horrible industry. But yet this is what we now call a civilized cultural event. This is, we think it's so important this day. It's such a holy day that we actually give everybody a holiday. It's just amazing. So the devotees take advantage of that and have an opportunity to actually present, like Lord Nityananda, the holy name to these people that are going out there for sense gratification. People that are gambling their hard-earned money on some whimsical race, and they think it is culturally very civilized. So the devotees are going there to present Krishna consciousness, to present the holy name. They don't want any part of spiritual life on this day. What they want to do is they want to drink, they want to fornicate, they want to gamble, they want to break all the regulative principles in the span of a couple of hours and a couple of times over. This is what they want. So the devotees see that these are Naradamas, we're going to actually give them the mercy. And we do. The holy name of the Lord is so powerful that it'll penetrate the hearts of all these living conditioned souls, all these people that are illusioned, all these people that are ignorant, and the holy name somehow or other will find a place in their hearts and will fructify at some point. We are actually, you know, there's a rampant disease of ignorance, and the devotees are going out with injections of the panacea and giving everyone a little shot through their ears, through the holy name. So this chanting is so powerful. And then that love of Godhead in the encapsulated form of the holy name will be placed in their heart and awaken, because we understand from what we were saying in the early part that each living entity is an eternal servant of God. Each living entity is part and parcel of the Supreme Lord. Even these fools that are going to this cup are part and parcels of the Supreme Lord. They are also eternal, fragmental parts of the Lord, steeped in deep ignorance, very deep Naradamas, you know. So this is an opportunity, and the mercy of the Lord, the mercy of the devotees, the grace of the devotees is that they're making an effort to go out there and try and encourage these people in their spiritual life. So this is an amazing thing. And that's our service. And it's joyfully performed. It's not like we're going out there and it's not like Lord Nityananda and Advaita Acharya were going, oh, I don't know about this, I'm not too happy about this service, you know. And say to Lord Chaitanya, oh, I don't know about this, I'm not keen on this. No! Devotees are happy. You know, the devotees are enthusiastic. Oh, we're going to go and give them heaps today. We're going out to the, you know, Kanupati has made up these big posters and encouraging everybody to come out, and it's just like, oh, we're going to have a fun time. You know, the ladies are getting dressed up and they're going to go out there and give them the mercy. So service for devotees is always ecstatic, always fun. Prabhupada used to say Krishna consciousness is a party at every moment. Every moment when we're doing our service with full intention, with full absorption, it's a blast every day. So it's an adventure every day. So they're the Naradamas. The third type that Prabhupada mentions in that purport of the Bhagavad Gita is the Mayaya Paritagyana, those who are erudite scholars and who are nullified by the illusory energy. So you've got those scholars, the philosophers, the atheists, the people that word juggle things around to make things, the material world, seem more appealing. The ones that say that after death, that's it, there's nothing else. You've got the scientists who see the mechanisms of creation as nothing more than just a chance happening. They see a fly, and a simple little fly or a mosquito, and they think that its creation is just a chance of nature. But when you analyse it, you say, my dear scientists, can you make this mosquito? Can you make this fly? Can you make a machine like that? Oh, in the future we may be able to, but they can't. They can't replicate anything that's so perfectly created. And they dare to say that there is no creative intelligence behind it all. They have intelligence, and they're trying to put this little machine together to make something that looks like a fly, but the fly is there and has been created by the Lord. What to speak of the whole universe and universes, endless, eternal. When you ask a scientist to actually define eternality, they can't. They can't. And similarly, you have politicians. They have this whole philosophy of democracy, understanding democracy. But they want democracy without God consciousness, which is impossible. They say all men are equal. Well, how are they equal? Tell me how they equal in your materialistic understanding. We're all different. Someone is stronger, they can lift many weights. Somebody might not be able to lift. Somebody's more artistic and creative. Someone can sing better than another person. Someone is more adept at mathematics, and someone's more adept in science of some other description. We're not equal. In no way, shape or form are we ever equal. And yet, in democracy, they see everything as we have the right because we're all equal. But how are we equal? We're equal in the eyes of God. We're equal in the metaphysical sense, not in the spiritual sense, in the metaphysical sense, in a transcendental sense, in that we are all children of God. We are all creations of God. That's how we're equal. But they don't see that. So you have the artist who portrays the world in nonsensical ways, in just a flippant way, in abstract or perverse sort of presentations, instead of actually perceiving there is abstraction, but it's perfectly ordered and it's perfectly justified. So you have writers in this material world. Again, these are also this third class of miscreant, that writers who write all sorts of nonsense. How many books are out there now? You go on the internet, you can publish your own book. It's a big thing now in all the retirement villages, because my mother is in that retirement village. It's a big thing in retirement villages to write your biography. Well, write your biography of what? What have you achieved? What have you done? You wasted your life. It's just like the king, same thing. He's writing his diary. What have I done? I've wasted a complete life. And they write it. And then they got this little book. This is my life. What would we do? What have you done? But the devotee, when you read the life, the autobiography of a devotee, it's so captivating, so enthralling, so uplifting. Who's read the biography of Radhanathaswami? Who could put the book down? You couldn't put it down. If you haven't read this book, I honestly recommend all of you to read it. It is so uplifting, such a spiritual surcharge. Here is a man who hasn't wasted his life, who's utilized his human form of life to advance spiritually, to serve the Lord. And every step of the way, it's just like such another blissful. And the pastimes that he has, and how the Lord plays with him in his service to Krishna, in his search for Krishna, is fascinating. And each one of us could write a similar book that would be really interesting on how we came to Krishna consciousness and how Krishna's guiding us. That's a real autobiography. That's really worthwhile reading. So these other writers, and they've got magazines and this thing and that thing. There's just so much literature, online books now. It's just, but it's all a waste of time, all useless stuff. So the fourth type and the final miscreant that Prabhupada mentions in that purport is the Asura Bhavam Ashrita. And that is the demoniac, the openly atheistic personality. Believe me, there are only a small percentage of them amongst us, but they are amongst us. These are demons. And we have to be on guard for demons. They are amongst us. Prabhupada said that there are even demons within our ISKCON. Prabhupada even said that. There are demoniac personalities who have taken to coming to the movement. Their sole purpose is to decry God, to disrupt human society, to infiltrate human society. They are happy to see suffering of humankind. And we have to be on our guard. Within our politicians, within our leaders, the demoniac. The majority, Prabhupada said, of society is 99% innocent. But there are some demoniac forces. And we can see it throughout history. There are personalities like Hitler, Pol Pot, Stalin, all these personalities who are bent on destroying human civilization, killing millions of people, torturing millions of people. So we have to be on guard. And there are even so-called demons, demoniac personalities, that will infiltrate different religious institutions and try and coerce their members to do abominable things in the name of religion. Very, very demoniac things in the name of religion. And coerce and confuse and cajole people into thinking that this is the right way for me to act. That I can kill anybody, that I can blow up anybody, that I can destroy things, that I can hurt people, and it's in the name of God. This is absolute nonsense. So Jesus said, warned about that. Be careful of the people, the wolves that are dressed in sheep's clothing. So we have to be very, very mindful that we are always on guard for these demons. And these demons are also 100% against the Hare Krishna movement. Because they know that what we're presenting is the highest truth in this civilization. The highest truth. The ability to actually liberate people from this material coil. To actually free people. So the demon wants to stop this. And so we always have to be on guard. And we always have to rely on Krishna to protect us. So the king admits that Urvasi is not to blame. And he's coming to his senses. He's becoming normal. He's becoming sane. And that actually he saw her as an object of his own personal sense gratification. We have to be mindful of that. We have to control our senses. We have to be very, very much diligent in suppressing our sense gratification in every way. And we do that by wholeheartedly engaging this body that houses us, this vehicle that we've got. We utilize this vehicle in total service to Krishna, as instructed by our Guru Maharaj and by Srila Prabhupada. Just engaging this body 100% in service. And then what happens is, then we're able to make advancement and grow. There was an interesting thing that Kadambakananda Maharaj was told me, and I'll finish up with that. He said to me that Jai Vaita Swami told him one time that he was in New York, downtown New York. And Jai Vaita Swami, those of you that know Jai Vaita Swami, he's a very monastic looking sannyasi. He looks like a monk. He really is very saintly personality. So he was walking in New York and a policeman stopped him and said, you're a monk. Can you tell me what I would have to give up to be a monk like you? You know, what would I have to give up in my life to be a monk like you? What do you think Maharaj would have said? Any takers? What do you think? What do we have to give up as devotees? Huh? Come on. Yeah, Prabhu. Huh? You heard it. You heard the story. Ah, you spoil sport. Maharaj said the only thing that we have to give up is suffering. And that's it. By becoming a devotee and serving the Lord, serving Srila Prabhupada, serving our Guru Maharaj, we give up suffering. And that is it. All these other things are byproducts. It's easy to follow the simple regulations that are laid down by the Shastras, simply offering everything that we eat to the Lord, by simply associating with devotees, having kirtan and engaging this body in service. That's all we have to do. And then we give up suffering. We don't want to suffer anymore. These people are going, you tell me, who going to the cup today, materialist going to the cup today, is really going to enjoy. They're all going to suffer. Even the winners will suffer. Number first off, it's going to be a wet, miserable day. You know, they've got their whole finery. They spent literally thousands on their wardrobe. You know, the ladies with their nice feathers in their hat, when it rains it all just goes... all their makeup starts running. The guys have got their nice new suits on and everything, and it rains and they'll slip over in the mud. And then they'll drink and they'll vomit over each other and all this kind of... Believe me, it's true. Who's done Sankirtan? Where's Gyana? We used to do Sankirtan at the Melbourne Cup. We used to go as a Sankirtan leader, I used to get the devotees to go and collect. You know, like we do stickers and flags and everything. Some of the devotees are there today, actually. Adi Purush Prabhu is here from Canberra. And Parama Karunya is here also. And he's collecting for both Melbourne and for Govardhan. So he's engaging these people. But we used to do it on a big scale. Like all of us here would be going to the cup. And I used to have a van in the car park, and we'd have samosas and kachoris and everything. And then the devotees would go in and hit people up with flowers and with stickers and everything. And then some would get kicked out. And then we'd climb the scale of the walls again and go back in. And they made a lot of Lakshmi and liberated a lot of Lakshmi for Srila Prabhupada and for the temple here. That's why we've got such a nice temple here, from the efforts of these young devotees in those days. They were really gutsy. They were really amazing. And they loved it. It was like an adventure. It was like a SWAT team, you know. Okay, now the guard's not watching. Go! And he'd run and climb over the fence, you know. And the girls would be going into the members. You know the members section? That's the elite section, right? And the way they used to do it, Bhakti will tell you all about it. The way they used to do it was, if some elderly old gentleman would be going, ew, going to the races, you know, and he's got his tuxedo on and his top hat and everything. And to get in there, you have to have a special pass. Now, in the members, there's all the rich people. And so to get in there, it's very difficult. So the devotee ladies, they'd all be dressed up and everything, and they'd have their bag. And then they'd shimmy up to this old gentleman, you know. Oh, hi, how are you?
Oh, very good, my dear.
And the girl would put their arm around the old man, and the old man would walk through the entrance gate, you know, and the girl would say, I'm with him. Oh, yeah, go right on in. And then when they're in there, see you later. And start engaging people and becoming... So, you know, Bhakti actually hit up the former Prime Minister of Australia, Malcolm Fraser, and she's proud of that. But she was so frightened she forgot to ask for very much, and here we would have given more Lakshmi. Yeah, it was bona fide. It was for food for life. But some of the stories. So we know at the end of the whole race, devotees would still be there, and you would see these intoxicated men and women all over the racetrack. They would just drop. You know, they were so intoxicated, so completely inebriated, that there they were with their beautiful dresses and their suits and their finery, laid out. And it was horrible. And they're lying in their own vomit. Some of them, yeah, no, seriously, some of them couldn't control their waterworks and they were all wet. And it's just a mess. So the devotees showed mercy by actually giving them the opportunity to engage in devotional service. And we have the opportunity now to also engage them in devotional service by hearing the holy name of the Lord. Those days of the Sankirtan that way have now past, and we do it in a different way. We don't have to do it that way anymore because of the connection with so many nice devotees. But in the past, that's what we had to do. So I'd like to give you an opportunity to be part of that and go on Harinam if we can. So you've made all the arrangements and everything, Prabhu, have you? Everybody knows?
Yeah, we're meeting in the courtyard at 10.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be taking...
A tram?
The city, yeah, so, a apparently there's no way to drive it because apparently the car park got flooded from all the rain during the week.
Yeah.
So everyone needs to go past us.
Oh, fine. Yeah. Amazing. So get your best voice and your best sari and your best dhoti and look the part and have a great day today in Sankirtan and liberate these people at the Melbourne Cup. Any comments or questions at all, Prabhu? Yes, Prabhu? Yep.
Regarding Narada, the other day at work, I said to somebody who's talking about civilization, I said, uncivilized, you eat like a civilized person can do things like that.
Huh.
Yeah. But he took it as a person and he doesn't speak to me anymore.
Really?
That's a better way to approach the situation.
Yeah. You have to sort of tolerate some nonsense stuff like that. That's the same with me in doing, you know, interfaith work. These people are trying their hardest to be spiritual people, but you know, they have some pretty bad habits. So you just have to be really clear where you stand as far as what your principles are, and you don't judge them for what they're doing. You just say, well, that's very good for you, sir, but I prefer to live this clean lifestyle by being vegetarian and so on and so forth. It's not that I'm putting you down at all. You live the way you want to live. It's more important that you befriend that person. I keep on repeating that. But it's more important that you maintain a friendship instead of turning the person off. So whatever they're doing at the moment, I mean, people can change like that. There are devotees here that were full-on meat eaters, and within a span of a couple of weeks' association with devotees, gave up meat eating and became vegetarian for the whole of their life. We're all coming from really bad backgrounds. Really bad backgrounds. We've committed so many sinful activities. It wasn't that long ago that we were like them, that we would be going to the cup, that we would be intoxicated. I've got nothing to be proud of. I mean, I was also like that. My spiritual master saved me. Prabhupada saved me. You know, I used to slaughter animals. That's how low of the low I was. I slaughtered animals. I killed them, you know, for an income. Can you believe that as a young person? It's something that I have to live with, you know, that I could actually stoop that low. But, you know, that was me. And I ate meat. But somehow or other, by the mercy of the Guru and Krishna and friendship of the devotees, I was able to get a better way. Same as the king here, you know. He's coming to his senses. We have to allow people to come to their senses. So the best way to do that is by friendship. Appreciating that there is a better way for them, but don't push them. Don't push them. Don't criticize them. Just let them be. And you be a good example, and then they'll follow your example. Is that okay? Any other comments or questions at all, Prabhu? Yeah, Prabhu?
The aborigines, do they have a name of their...
Yes, I want to find out. It's different in different languages. Because there are so many Aboriginal languages, there really, there's about, oh, thousands. A lot of the languages are now lost. But a lot of the Aboriginal languages have different names for God. They're as different as Hindi and English between the different races of Aborigines. And actually, when you study some of the Aboriginal phrases, there's a great similarity between the southern Indian language. And there is a theory that the Aborigines of Australia were once the Aborigines in southern parts of India, and that there's a connection there. Yeah, it's quite fascinating when you hear the history. So, anyway, any other comments or questions? Yes, Prabhu?
Just a quick comment. It's irony when you say, when scientists say, for example, the mosquito example that you give, that they just came by chance. So they got like an audacity to say, the chance that created a mosquito. But if you just take that point to them and say, okay, it was a chance, and by chance it came such a beautiful thing, let's make a conscious end of work and see if you can create better than that.
That's right. They'll say to you, in due course of time we will. We just haven't got the information yet completely. So this is post-data check. Prabhupada calls this post-data check. It's nonsense. Word jugglery. You know? It's a nonsense. When you really analyse the whole evolutionary process, you know, the Darwinian theory, it's a nonsense. It makes no sense whatsoever. You know? But they're pushing it forward. And it's just their own ego that they can't come to the understanding that actually there's a force greater than me, and that's God. And if there is a force greater than me, then I have to surrender to that force. And that's what they don't want to do. And that's that point again of Saranagati. Surrender. You know? It's a big thing. People don't like to give away their sense gratification. Because they know what it'll mean if they have to surrender. You know? Does that make sense? But yeah, they can't make a fly. They can't make a flea. They can't make anything. And they claim themselves to be big, big scientists. You know? Okay, Prabhu, Srila Prabhupada ki.
Yeah.